BBC News.
Which was presented this evening by Vijay Alice.
I'm John Long, joined by Dr. Tara Shine,
a comedian and a scientist, helping you make the best environmental choices.
With laughs and, before they go out of fashion, actual facts.
In Ireland, 20% of the electricity in the country is used by data centres right now. And confessing their eco-sins, our special guests, including Beau Carter, Athena Coblenou and Chris McCausland.
I have an addiction to vinyl records.
And do you pass any of them on?
No, I keep them all because they take up space, it annoys my wife, and that in itself gives me immense pleasure.
Carbon Lifeform starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds
on Wednesday night at 6:30.
And now Radio 4, phones away and pencils at the ready as we head up to the northeast of England for another edition of Paul Sinha's Perfect Pub Quiz.
Geography and history and music, films and telly. Everyone who's ever lived from Taylor Swift to Botticelli. What a fun packed evening this is. Welcome to Paul Sinha's Perfect Pub Quiz.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for that wonderful round of applause, and welcome to an all-new episode of Paul Sinha's Perfect Pub Quiz, in which I, Paul Sinha, comedian, and the only professional quizzer to have met both Ravi Shankar and Ravi Shastri, attempt to put a new spin on a great British tradition. I'm delighted to say that the increasingly impressive BBC travel budget means that this show is being recorded in Sunderland. I'm delighted in that special sense of the word delighted, meaning slightly apprehensive. As you can tell from my accent, I'm not from Sunderland, and I don't want to make any clumsy faux pas that might make me sound patronising. A faux pas is a mistake, by the way. I know you knew that already. You Geordies, amongst the cleverest people on earth. Of course, a radio show is not the same as a pub quiz. If it were, many of you would now be on a team whose name is a weak pun on my name, or a hilarious statement about how you prefer Bradley or Pointless. Examples of the former include Sinner, Sinner, Chicken Dinner, then a Sinner Takes It All, and examples of the latter include We Prefer Pointless and We Prefer Bradley. As a special treat, at the last pub quiz I hosted, a very witty man thought it'd be very witty to wittily ask me, where's your white suit? On 5 separate occasions. What I said to him was, oh, I don't wear it outside the studio. But what I actually wanted to say was, yes, you've made your point 5 times already. You appear to be the most witless buffoon I've ever met. If you don't get out of my personal space, I will punch you in the face. Honestly, I've never understood the obsession with the white suit, or indeed the implication that I should wear my work clothes at the pub. The white suit has a noble tradition. The first ever celebrity to popularise its use. Anyone know which famous writer it was?
Mark Twain.
Brilliant answer over there. The answer is Mark Twain. Does anyone know what the name Mark Twain means?
2 fathoms.
Oh, we've got a good audience in already. It means 2 fathoms. Does anyone know how many feet there are in 2 fathoms?
16. 12.
It is actually 12. Sorry, 16. You're not good at maths. There are 6 feet in a fathom, so there's 12 feet in 2 fathoms. And can anyone tell me what was unusual about the dates of Mark Twain's birth and death?
Same day.
No, not quite.
He was born when he was common.
Yeah, he wasn't born when Halley's Comet first entered Earth's atmosphere. Halley's Comet has been entering Earth's atmosphere quite a lot of times over the years, but you're basically right. He was born in November 1835 and died in 1910, and on both occasions, Halley's Comet was visible, which is quite a coincidence given that Halley's Comet, like a genuinely left-wing government, is only seen every 75 or 76 years. Mark Twain famously predicted this when he said, I came in with Halley's Comet and I expect to go out with it. To which a stranger replied, where's your white suit, mate? It's not just America's greatest writer on the illustrious list of white-suited men. Partly as a tribute, which American author of Bonfire of the Vanities wore a white suit everywhere he went?
Tom Wolfe.
Thank you very much, Tom Wolfe over there. He rocked a white suit, helped by being 6'6". But he's not the tallest best-selling US author. That accolade, and as far as I can tell, the accolade for the tallest famous writer in history, goes to Michael Crichton, who came in at an amazing, anyone? 6'9". The clue was in his book Jurassic Park, when he described a Tyrannosaurus Rex as a short ass. At the other end of the scale, Charlotte Bronte was certainly no more than 4'10", which may make her the shortest novelist in history. Nonetheless, she was a giant compared to my next candidate for greatest white suit wearer of the 20th century. A French-born actor who found fame in Spain in the 1980s with his impersonation of Felipe González, Spain's longest-serving prime minister. I am, of course, talking about...
The man from Del Monte.
Not the man from Del Monte, no. Unlucky, that's a good guess. But I'm actually talking about Hervé Villechaize, the guy who played Nick Knack in The Man with the Golden Gun, and of course Tattoo in Fantasy Island. Now let's add the man who was succeeded by George Osborne in 2001. Anyone?
Martin Bell.
Martin Bell, succeeded as MP for Tatton. Tatton in Cheshire has only ever had four MPs, and they're all famous. Neil Hamilton, Martin Bell, George Osborne, and which current MP? The current MP for Tatton is Esther McVeigh, who, as far as I'm aware, is the only sitting MP to have both performed in the Vagina Monologues and presented shows on GB News. There is an obvious joke here, but I'm not saying it. The final candidate for this group of dapper men is Sidney Stratton. Does anyone know who Sidney Stratton is? He's a research chemist, and he's the title character of which famous 1951 Ealing comedy? I didn't ask you about Alec Guinness. Don't show off now. I was simply asking you the name of the film. The film is The Man in the White Suit. Not you. The Man in the White Suit was one of the earliest starring roles for which legendary actor? Well done, good answer there. Superbly stolen, brilliantly done. Alec Guinness, I absolutely love Alec Guinness, genuine class, which is of course an anagram of his name. He's the only actor to have been Oscar nominated for a role in the Star Wars franchise, despite correctly describing the films as fairy tale rubbish. And my big connection to Alec Guinness is that Alec Guinness portrayed Asian men in the films Lawrence of Arabia and A Passage to India, and I portrayed an Asian man in Life. Although, to be fair, Alec Guinness was a little bit more convincing. In addition to Alec Guinness, The Man in the White Suit is notable for featuring the film debut of a six-year-old actress called Mandy Miller. It was a piece of flute casting. Her father had taken on a visit to Ealing Studios. And during the morning, they went to the canteen, and the film's director, Alexander McKendrick, was there having a coffee. On spotting Mandy, he reportedly said, "That's a funny face. I could use that funny face in my next film." And thus history was made. That wouldn't happen these days. He would have said, "I could use that funny face in my next film, but I've already cast the executive producer's daughter." Only in Sunderland could he be heckled by live crime. Before we move on, does anyone have any questions?
Where's your white suit?
You, sir, are a witless buffoon.
The 1957 film The King of New York is the only film that starred Charlie Chaplin in which British comedy legend was associated with Sunderland, or has an association with Sunderland.
Irene Handel.
Sid James.
Oh, Sid James, yes. Associated with Sunderland in that he died at the Sunderland Empire.
That's correct, yeah.
Keep it light, Michael, keep it light.
It's a Formula One question.
Okay.
There's only been one Grand Prix where only one driver pulled up to start on the starting grid. Which Grand Prix, who was the only driver to start on the starting grid?
Wow, now that's a tough question, isn't it? And I have literally no idea, so I'm going to say the US Grand Prix.
It was Hungary 2021, and Lewis Hamilton was the only driver. All of the other drivers had pulled into the pit lane to change tyres because of the weather.
Well, I never. Great question. Round of applause for that one. We've got an audience in today, haven't we? Your next question. Who are the only two out gay winners of I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here? Christopher Gins, very good. He won in Series 7, 2007. Oh, no, he didn't. Oh, yes, he did. Very, very good. Sunderland's very own Jill Scott, born in Sunderland in 1987. Jill Scott is the most English of heroes in that despite scoring 26 goals in 161 international appearances for England, she was largely unknown to the great British public until in the final of the 2022 Euros, she quite clearly told a German footballer to F off, you effing prick. It is hard to imagine that anything could endear her more to the British public. And yet later that year, she won I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, beating into third place Matt Hancock. All the while, she was so open and upfront about her sexuality that not even Matt Hancock tried to make a move. It seems that the Lionesses can't seem to stop winning games of football, showing up their male counterparts by employing the tactic of persuading their opponents to take really shit penalties. And as a result, the women's game has become a go-to topic for any quiz writer. Unfortunately, it's become very difficult to keep up. For instance, in the last series of this show, I announced with breathless excitement that the Zambian footballers Rachel Kundananji and Barbara Banda were the two most expensive female footballers in the world. I've looked closer at the matter, and it seems it's a little bit more complicated than that. There have been seven more expensive transfers this year alone, and now at the top of the list is either the Mexican Lisbeth Avalo or the French Grace Guioro, depending on whether you believe Paris Saint-Germain, who sold Guioro, or London City Lionesses, who bought her. I must say, it's great to see the women's game catching up with the men's game when it comes to financial transparency. God bless Sunderland, the home of Jill Scott, is also the home of former England captain Steph Houghton, who officially has freedom of the city of Sunderland. That is a lot of charity shops to get around. This, of course, makes Sunderland the British city where you kick like a girl is most likely to be a compliment. But it is, of course, men's football where Sunderland has made its most famous sporting contributions. For instance, at least once a year, for the last 25 years, a complete stranger has walked up to me and said, Sunderland did it in 1979, Villa did it in 1981, who did it in 1980? Anyone? It is, of course, Trevor Brooking. I knew you'd know. It's a trick question. It's got nothing to do with Sunderland AFC and everything to do with a man called Alan Sunderland who scored the winning goal in the 1979 FA Cup final. And Villa here refers to Ricky Villa, who scored the winning goal in 1981. So the answer is Trevor Brooking, who scored the winning goal in 1980, while yet again not being booked. Younger listeners may be unaware of just how knowledgeable certain generations are about FA Cup finals of their youth. Take that 1979 final. I support neither Arsenal nor Man United, yet I can remember the goal scorers, the dramatic finale. I remember that Brian Talbot became the first player in history to win successive FA Cup finals with different teams. I remember that afternoon, my mum had made a particularly nice lamb curry with chapati and coleslaw. That comes up less often in quizzes, but occasionally. So imagine my delight this year when there was a new FA Cup final fact. Crystal Palace's Ebere Eze became the first footballer since Newcastle's George Hannah in 1955 to complete what niche football achievement? I'll give you a clue. Eze is spelled E-Z-E. Palindromes. George Hannah and Ebere Eze are the two footballers to score in an FA Cup final whose surname reads the same way forward as it does backwards. That's a proper fact. It's a bit of a shame that Sunderland have never won the FA Cup because I enjoy the process of unearthing local sporting trivia. So that wasn't a punchline. What was that laughed about?
Twice.
What?
The one in 1937, 1973.
This is really embarrassing.
1937 and 1973.
Oh, 1937, when you beat Preston North End 3-1. and 1973, when you shocked the world by beating Leeds United 1-0 in the final. Ian Porterfield scored the winning goal in the 32nd minute. Bob Stoker was the manager. Bobby Kerr captained the team. Jim Montgomery, the most famous double save in football history. And bizarrely, Jim Montgomery wasn't even the only Jim Montgomery to have an annus mirabilis in 1973, because the American swimmer Jim Montgomery won 5 gold medals at the inaugural World Swimming Championships in 1973. I was playing with you. I'm aware what happened in 1973, but let's be honest, for the last 50 years, you've never stopped going on about it. I was just playing with you there. Of course, 1937, 1973, Sunderland remained the only team whose 2 FA Cup wins were in years that were anagrams of each other. I'm well aware of Sunderland's sporting pedigree, both the club and the city. Which sitcom star and a winner of 11 primetime Emmys shares their surname with their third cousin, the owner of Sunderland AFC? First name?
Julia
Louis-Dreyfus. The star of Seinfeld and Veep is the cousin of Kirill Louis-Dreyfus, the entire family being noted French billionaires. Against which team did Jordan Pickford become the first English goalkeeper to conquer a World Cup penalty shootout?
Colombia,
very good. Which Sunderland-born footballer left Liverpool to join Saudi team Al Ettifaq in 2023 in one fell swoop, losing his massive gay fan base? That is, of course, Jordan Henderson. I feel in a good position to comment on Henderson's decision because I have Parkinson's disease, which is much like being a professional footballer in Saudi Arabia. You know the Sheikh's about to take over your life. I sense some resistance to that joke at the moment. Let me remind you, that's the single greatest joke you're ever going to hear to combine modern football politics and progressive neurological degeneration. Before we continue, does anyone have any questions?
I used to read the Eagle comic books when I was a child.
Correct, that's true.
That's it, thank you very much. Can you tell me Dan Dare's middle name?
No.
Correct.
What is Dan Dare's middle name?
It's McGregor.
McGregor, thank you very much.
We're just wondering if you know how many times Dolly Parton says the word Jolene in the song.
Let's start. Jolene. 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 I'm going to guess at 48.
31.
Oh. Well done. Thank you very much for those questions, ladies and gentlemen. We now return to questions related either directly or tangentially to Sunderland, once voted the second most beautiful city on the River Weir. How do we better know the writer born in Sunderland in 1916 as James Alfred White?
James Herriot.
It is indeed James Herriot, author of the books that inspired the television series All Creatures Great and Small. And can anyone tell me which actor first played Siegfried Farnan in the 1975 film version of All Creatures Great and Small? It's not Simon Ward. That's a good answer, but he was in the sequel. No, that he was in the TV show.
Anthony Hopkins.
A round of applause for that amazing answer there. Anthony Hopkins was Siegfried Farnan and Hannibal Lecter. He knew more than one way to silence a lamb. Your next question. Which writer, born in Sunderland in 1946, once said, "Kids should leave school at 11 and go to work. Not down the mines or up chimneys, but working with computers or something relevant." It is the surprisingly curmudgeonly Terry Deary, creator of the hugely successful Horrible Histories franchise. He and James Herriot are the two best-selling writers to have been born in Sunderland. And if you're wondering which school inspired Terry Deary's very negative views on the values of a traditional education, it is Monkwearmouth School. whose other most famous alumnus is sweary football hero Jill Scott. You might think that for a successful children's author, Terry Deary's views on education are borderline Gerald Ratner, but in recent years, he's become well known for his contrarian views, also regularly displaying his hatred of public libraries and indeed most of the civilizations he wrote about. Among the many alliterative titles he wrote were Rotten Romans, Vicious Vikings, Angry Aztecs, Terrible Tudors, Slimy Stuarts, Vile Victorians, Villainous Victorians. We get it, Terry. You don't like Queen Victoria. It seems that Monk Wearmouth School's most famous alumni, Terry Deary and Jill Scott, were both known for their colourful language and their hatred of German women. So James Herriot and Terry Deary, entertaining writers, but it seems that Sunderland's contribution to the world of literature isn't massive. But the story doesn't end with people who were born in Sunderland. Your next question is one I suspect most of you will know. According to a 2007 graphic novel, and indeed the best efforts of Mowbray Park, which Victorian author, and indeed mathematician, has many of his most creative ideas heavily inspired by his regular visits to Sunderland? Lewis Carroll. It is Lewis Carroll. Although born in Cheshire, dying in Guildford, and being mostly associated with the city of Oxford, unlikely as it may seem, it is Sunderland who've really tried hard to lay claim to him. Thanks to the best-selling 2007 graphic novel, Alice in Sunderland. Can anyone tell me who wrote it? Someone got it over here. Brian Talbot. If that name sounds familiar, Brian Talbot, the graphic novelist, is not the same person as Brian Talbot, the Ipswich and then Arsenal footballer who in 1979 became the first man to win successive FA Cup finals for two different teams in a match where the winning goal was scored by Alan Sunderland. It is a niche mnemonic, but it's got me some vital pub quiz points over the years. It seems that Lewis Carroll spent many happy holidays in Sunderland. The poem The Walrus and the Carpenter was inspired by a stuffed walrus in a Sunderland museum, and indeed by a carpenter he'd had a brief chat with at the beach. In honour of this connection, as I'm sure you know, Mowbray Park has a large statue of a walrus. Does anyone know why there's no statue of a carpenter?
Pinched.
Didn't get pinched, no. No, the reason there's no carpenter is they ran out of money. They couldn't afford to put a new one. I can't help think, if you're going to build a statue of a walrus and a carpenter, start with the little one. I, for one, have no idea to what degree Sunderland's claim to Lewis Carroll's creativity is tenuous or not. But it does make sense for the tourist board to milk it for all it's worth. Lewis Carroll, after all, his legacy includes many linguistic treats. My personal favourite is the portmanteau. Can anyone tell me what a portmanteau is?
Suitcase.
What a splendiferous answer. Truly fantabulous. That's right. A portmanteau is a rigid framed leather trunk popular for carrying clothes in the 19th century France. But it's also a word created by combining two other words. I love portmanteau. I would. I'm a Gaysian workaholic. I love the fact that which character introduced the concept of the linguistic portmanteau in Through the Looking Glass? It's actually Humpty Dumpty, which is appropriate, really, because his original story of falling off a wall is very much the original dramedy. I love the fact that portmanteau is, in fact, a portmanteau of the French words porte, meaning to carry, and manteau, to hide or cloak. I love the fact that sometimes one portmanteau results from another, like, for instance, Brexit and stagflation. Or that some portmanteau basically mean the same thing, such as bromance and podcast. But most of all, I love the fact that many portmanteau make great quiz facts. Here's one. Until his death on Coniston Water in 1967, Donald Campbell, the son of the legendary Malcolm Campbell, was the most prolific breaker of the world water speed record. Which frequently heard portmanteau did Donald Campbell coin in his 1955 book, Into the Water Barrier? I'm not going to give you a clue here. The answer is Labradoodle. I think it's fair to say that you weren't expecting that answer. Donald Campbell was the first person to combine the words Labrador and poodle to make a labradoodle to describe his companion, Maxie. Don't worry, Maxie was a dog. It's easy to mock the concept of designer dogs, but I will point out at this point that the first deliberately bred labradoodle was created as a hypoallergenic guide dog for a blind woman whose husband was allergic to dog hair. Labradoodle, though, banging fat. And your final question, in 1951, the six-year-old actress Mandy Miller made her screen debut in the film The Man in the White Suit, starring Alec Guinness. I mentioned her earlier. 5 years later, she made the first recording of which song, one of the earliest to be produced by George Martin?
And which is that dog in the window?
No, that wasn't the first recording of the song, no. I don't know how you're answering these questions, but the answer is Nelly the Elephant. And why have I asked this question at this particular venue?
Toy
the Toy Dolls. 38 years later, the Toy Dolls cover version of Nelly the Elephant became the highest ever charting single for any band entirely from Sunderland. The three highest charting singles by bands from Sunderland and Nelly the Elephant by the Toy Dolls, the Futureheads with their cover of Hounds of Love, and reaching number 21, John Ketley is a Weatherman by A Tribe of Toffs. No offence, Sunderland, that's two novelty hits and two covers. It's not that rich a heritage. When it comes to music, you're happy for other people to mack 'em and then you tech 'em. Does anyone have any final questions?
I'll try and give you a chance. what? What was Ian Porterfield's shirt number? As you've researched it.
I did not research things I'll never need to know for the rest of my life. I'm going to guess 8.
10.
10.
Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Just another Formula One question for you. Sebastian Vettel's a four-time world champion. Which circuit did he first ever win his first race?
Imola?
No. It was Monza in Italy in 2008 for Toro Rosso in the wet.
Thank you very much for that question. Well done. Hopefully, we've learned a lot in this episode. We've learned that Mowbray Park can't afford a carpenter. We've learned that Donald Campbell was a very big fan of designer dogs. We've learned that I've somehow managed to listen and hallucinate 17 extra versions of the word Jolene in the Dolly Parton hit. And we've learned that the best chart advice for any Sunderland band is to cover a song sung by an 11-year-old singing about a travelling circus. Thank you for listening. Good day to you.
Paul Sinha's Perfect Pub Quiz was presented and written by me, Paul Sinha, with additional material by Oliver Levy and additional questions by the audience. The producer was Ed Morrish, and it was a Lead Mojo production for BBC Radio 4.
Paul will be back in Ayr at the same time next week with questions about popes, universities and a few Scottish islands, amongst others. Tomorrow night at 6.30, meanwhile, we continue the new series of Mark's Deals in Town, when Mark will be paying a visit to Wrexham, something of a Hollywood hotspot these days, as we'll be hearing. And if you missed Mark last week, here he is now with a recap of what became something of a double act, I think it's fair to say.
What happens when a Radio 4 rambler walks into a comedy show? Have you looked into where we're going yet?
No.
Oh. Claire Baldin trades muddy boots for the mic and joins me on stage in Rutland.
I don't think we can get lost, can we?
And I return the favour, joining Claire for a countryside walk on Ramblings.
Is this all you two do is go around the country laughing?
You said yeah, actually.
The new series of Mark Steals in Town begins in Rutland.
Can't come in here without a wax jacket.
From BBC Radio 4, listen now on BBC Sounds.
And you can find the Ramblings edition on BBC Sounds as well. Back to this evening, and there is a shock ahead for David in the Archers in a couple of minutes after the news.